is for What's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Some 30,000 Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga and Sunni tribal fighters are engaged in a long-anticipated assault to retake the northern Iraqi city of Mosul from a two-year Islamic State occupation. The air and ground assault was launched early Monday from multiple directions against an estimated IS force of between 4,000 and 8,000. U.S. Defense spokesman Peter Cook said the fight is carrying a great deal of symbolic importance.
Over 2 years, ISIL has brutalized the city's population, committing horrific atrocities. This is a fight to free hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis from ISIL's rule.
Iraqi Kurdish President Masoud Barzani said about 200 square kilometers have already been liberated. The commander of the U.S.-led coalition backing the offensive, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, warned the operation could take weeks or longer. The U.N. resident and humanitarian coordinator for Iraq, Lisa Grand, expressed alarm over the fate of hundreds of thousands of civilians.
We would expect that up to a million civilians would try and leave the city. Of the million, upwards of 700,000 people would need some kind of shelter. They would be unable to reach villages, or they wouldn't be sponsored. They would depend upon us to be in a camp or to be in a tent or to receive some kind of direct assistance.
U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter called the battle the decisive moment in the campaign to deliver the IS group a lasting defeat. Gunmen in Niger Monday attacked a high-security prison housing Islamist militants in an apparent bid to free them, but were repulsed. Local governor Sholoutan Mohammed said the situation is under control. He said attackers are on the run, being pursued. One attacker was killed. Two guards were wounded. This is VOA News. The Russian Defense Ministry announced Monday that Russian and Syrian armed forces are preparing for an 8-hour humanitarian pause in the embattled Syrian city of Aleppo Thursday. Lieutenant General Sergei Rutskoy said the October 20 pause would last from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. local time, allowing for the free passage of civilians, evacuation of the sick and wounded, and withdrawal of fighters. He said there would be two corridors by which people could leave the city. U.S. spokesman Mark Toner called it too little, too late.
I guess we'll see. You know, if there is actually an 8-hour pause and the unremitting suffering of the people of Aleppo, that would be a good thing. But frankly, it's a bit too little too late.
New air attacks Monday in and around Aleppo killed dozens of civilians, including children. Hundreds have died in a pro-government assault launched over the past month. The UN Security Council has strongly condemned North Korea's recent failed missile launch and threatened additional sanctions. The council said the launch was in grave violation of several past UN resolutions, and Pyongyang must refrain from further testing of ballistic missiles and nuclear devices. The North tried to launch an intermediate-range ballistic missile Saturday, but it exploded after liftoff. A longtime prisoner at the U.S. Military Detention Center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, who wrote about his 14 years of detention, has been freed and returned to his native Mauritania. Mohamedou Ould Slahi, author of Guantanamo Diary, was suspected of having links to al-Qaeda, but insisted he had joined the anti-communist Mujahideen in Afghanistan. He was questioned about involvement in an abandoned plot to set off explosives at the Los Angeles International Airport New Year's Eve 1999. At least 14 people were killed over the weekend in clashes between Fulani herdsmen and local farmers in Nigeria's Kaduna State. Some were hacked to death, others burned beyond recognition. Clashes over grazing rights have occurred in the past between the Muslim Fulani herders and largely Christian farmers of central Nigeria. At least 19 people perished in a private hospital fire in the eastern Indian city of Bhubaneswar Monday. The blaze broke out in the dialysis ward. Dozens of patients were transferred to other hospitals, some in critical condition. The house in which Nazi leader Adolf Hitler was born may soon be demolished. Austria's interior minister said a new building could take its place. Wolfgang Swoboda spoke to an Austrian newspaper. He said a government commission determined that the house in the town of Braunau am Inn near Germany could either be torn down or altered in hopes this will end a difficult chapter regarding the large yellow corner house where Hitler was born April 20, 1889. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. 21 Chibok girls rescued this week in Nigeria have been reunited with their families.
When she saw me, she couldn't say anything. She was just crying, you know. She was saying it was just like a dream, as if something they've given up on. They never thought they would make it through.
Dr. Ali Manas said is the cousin of one of the rescued Chibok girls. Equatorial Guinea tells the International Court of Justice that France should stop its corruption case against President Teodoro's son. South Sudan Army said it repelled rebel attacks in weekend fighting near Malakal town, and Ghana police to meet with stakeholders ahead of the December presidential election.
We are not preparing only in terms of our logistics and equipment. We are also trying to bring everybody on board, especially stakeholders, to this election. And we are scheduled to meet with the Islamic community.
Sifas Alpha is the spokesman for the Ghanaian police. Amnesty International says Australia's treatment of refugees amounts to torture, and technology gives students the tools for cheating in school. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The 21 girls released by Nigerian militant group Boko Haram have been reunited with their families, and Nigeria's government has raised the prospect of negotiating the release of an additional 83. From Abuja, Chika Odua has the latest.
These are the voices of families in tears as they celebrate the return of 21 Chibok girls.
When she saw me, she couldn't say anything. She was just crying, you know. And she was saying it was just like a dream, as if it's something they've given up on. They never thought they would make it through. But lo and behold, they are out. And it's that smell of freedom or something else.
Dr. Alan Manasseh described the moment one of his cousins saw him on Sunday at the official reunion ceremony with other Chibok families in Abuja. He reunited with two of his cousins who were kidnapped by Boko Haram in April 2014 from their secondary school in Chibok. One is named Gloria Dame, who was 18 years old when she was kidnapped. The other one is Mariamu Lawan. When he saw them, he became overwhelmed. He also notes they look like they had suffered.
I say it's difficult to describe the feeling, you know. They look leaner than when they were abducted.
None of his cousins came back with any children, Manasseh says. He also said they told him they were not forced to marry any Boko Haram members. But their lean bodies are proof that they experienced hunger while they were held captive by Boko Haram. One of the cousins, Gloria, said some of the girls had no food to eat for 40 days. The Nigerian government says talks are continuing to bring back another 83 of the nearly 200 girls kidnapped by Boko Haram. Whether or not a ransom was paid for the 21 released last week remains unclear. The Nigerian government denied a report from the Associated Press that millions of dollars were paid by the Swiss government on behalf of Nigeria. The Nigerian government also says no imprisoned Boko Haram members were exchanged for the girls. But Iman Shehu, one of the leaders of the Bring Back Our Girls movement that has advocated for the kidnapped girls' release, doubts the government's story.
We think that something happened. That even when government say officially nothing happened, it turns out that something did happen. That has always been the history of negotiating for hostages in the hands of terrorists.
Shehu says the group will watch for the rest of the month to see if other girls are rescued. If not, it will continue to put pressure on the Nigerian government. For now, Chibok families will hold on to the memory of what it felt like to hold their daughters for the first time in 2 years. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
Ghanaian police plan to meet this week with leaders of the Muslim community as part of their effort to meet with all stakeholders ahead of presidential, legislative, and local elections scheduled for December 7th this year. Inspector General of Police John Kudalo met recently with the Catholic Bishops' Conference in the northern regional capital, Tamale. Other stakeholders the police have met with so far include the National Media Commission, the media, the National Peace Council, various political groupings, and the Christian Council of Ghana. Police spokesman Cephas Arthur tells viewers Peter Clotty. The police have also launched a nationwide education campaign using mass and social media platforms to engage the public regarding the need to ensure a peaceful general election.
We are not preparing only in terms of our logistics and equipment. We are also trying to bring everybody on board, especially stakeholders, to this election. And we are scheduled to meet with the Islamic community. Only last week, the IGP met the Catholic Bishop Conference far away in Tamale, in the northern part of the country. We see all these groupings as veritable stakeholders to this election. And that if we are able to bring all of them on board to judge or to find an amicable solution to all concerns that we have as far as this election is concerned, then we are sure that we'll be seeing the election through the same spectacle and that we shall surely succeed in having a peaceful election come December 7th. That is why we are taking all these steps. In addition, preparation as a police institution, we are set as far as our logistics and equipment and everything is concerned.
With these efforts, what about the public engagement to really explain and engage them to get their views about ensuring they comport themselves during the polls to make your work a little bit easier before, during, and after the elections?
At this level, too, I can assure you that our strategy is two-pronged. One is being headed by the community policing unit of the service, which is touring communities across the country, and explaining police operations, police activities to them as far as election is concerned. So we are not leaving any stone unturned.
Now, there were reports that the police have withdrawn officers assigned to some of these presidential candidates because the Electoral Commission disqualified them. What went into the thinking of the withdrawal of these police officers who were providing protection for them, particularly when some of these presidential candidates are fighting their disqualification in court?
The police commenced withdrawal of security details assigned the presidential aspirants a day after those presidential aspirants have been disqualified from running. In fact, it was upon the basis that was the condition upon which they were assigned. A number of meetings were held between the police and the various political parties. And it was agreed that although they hadn't been accepted or otherwise by the Electoral Commission, once their political parties had selected them to lead them, they were going to start with their campaigns. And so they needed some protection. So the police agreed to assign them those security details to take care of their security. And that, upon the acceptance or otherwise of the Electoral Commission, or awaiting the acceptance or otherwise of the Electoral Commission, it was agreed that if the Electoral Commission disqualified anybody, the police was going to withdraw such security details, because then the danger for which the person was going to be granted the security details ceases to exist, and it was understood. People were even saying that why didn't we wait till the Electoral Commission disqualified or accepted them before assigning? But then the argument was that once their parties had selected them to lead them, they had started their campaigns, and they needed the security for the campaigns. So it was agreed that we're going to assign them, and that when the Electoral Commission disqualified them, upon disqualification by the Electoral Commission, they will be withdrawn.
Cephas Arthur is a spokesman for the Ghana Police. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Accra. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 18th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Let's send shout out to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate stations: Liberty FM in Juba, South Sudan; Yambio FM in Yambio, South Sudan; Voice of the People Radio in Juba, South Sudan; and also Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi; and Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The International Court of Justice is holding hearings on demands by Equatorial Guinea that France halts its corruption case against the son of its long-term president, who is also vice president of the country. As Lisa Bryan reports from Paris, Theodorien Obiang is accused of using public funds to pay for his lavish lifestyle.
Luxury cars, famous paintings, cartons of red wine, and a six-story mansion in a chic neighborhood of Paris. Those were just part of the assets French authorities seized 4 years ago as they pursued a corruption case against Théodorin Obiang, son of Equatorial Guinea's hardline president, Teodoro Obiang Nguema. 47-year-old Obiang, who is also the country's vice president, has long been known for his jet-set lifestyle. His extravagant purchases include jets and Michael Jackson memorabilia. But on Monday, his lawyers argued before the International Court of Justice that French authorities, not Obiang, had violated the law.
Venimos ante ustedes hoy para solicitar medidas provisionales.
Lawyer Maurice Kamto told the Hague-based court that Obiang, as vice president and the Paris mansion, ostensibly part of Equatorial Guinea's embassy, benefited from diplomatic immunity. Lawyers for France will be making their arguments Tuesday. The case against Obiang was initially spearheaded by anti-corruption NGOs in France as part of broader charges against several African leaders. Last month, French judges ordered the seizure of properties belonging to the family of Republic of Congo's president, Denis Sassou Nguesso. International Federation for Human Rights Africa Director Florent Gel hopes the legal proceedings send a message that France is no longer a haven for corrupt leaders.
That means that we can't just say that we support, that the French government, for instance, support the people, their claimings, including for more democracy and the respect of human rights, and at the same time welcoming the massive perpetrators or even the people who are stealing their own people. It's a question of credibility and rationality.
Obiang has also faced embezzlement charges in the United States. Equatorial Guinea is rich in oil and gas, but the majority of its citizens live in poverty. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Fighting between South Sudan government forces and rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar broke out over the weekend. The South Sudan Army says it killed more than 50 rebels and members of militia groups and wounded several others in clashes that took place west of Malakal town. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Nairobi.
Government forces chant slogans of victories at Warjok, a village located 20 kilometers southwest of Malakal town, where government forces clashed with an SPLA-IO faction. South Sudan Army spokesman Brigadier General Lulu Roy Kwang took a group of journalists over the weekend to the scene of the clashes and declared that government forces inflicted heavy casualties on forces loyal to Machar.
Over 56 rebels were killed. We captured over 200 different types of weapons, and the two places they had attacked, Alelo and Werjok, remained under our control up to now. They are nowhere to be seen.
Kwang says the death toll among SPLA-IO could rise. Kwang says SPLA forces lost 4 fighters and 20 others were wounded in clashes that began on Friday evening. He says the fighting began when rebels, whom he calls terrorists, attacked SPLA positions at Warjok and Alelo village, 15 kilometers south of Malakal town, near strategic oil fields in the Upper Nile region.
We registered over 8 clashes here in Eastern Nile State, West Fashoda State, Southern Lige State. Because even in former Greater Equatoria, they had ambushed a number of commercial vehicles that were transporting civilians. So it was intensification of operations against government positions by Riek Machar's terrorists after he had declared war in Khartoum.
South Sudan in Focus could not independently verify Kwang's claims. SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Dixon Galuak says it was his forces that came under attack from government troops in the area. Gadluak says his forces will continue to defend themselves against the attacks by government forces.
We have realized that There is no political settlement in Juba. There is no any political space in Juba. So we have to organize ourselves because the government has failed.
The weekend clashes are the latest violation of the cessation of hostilities signed by the two warring parties in the August 2015 peace agreement. Machar proclaimed the 2015 peace deal dead in an exclusive interview with the South Sudan in Focus late last week. Control of Malakal town has exchanged hands several times between the government and rebel forces. Residents of the town witnessed several atrocities, including the killing of civilians by both the government and the SPLA-IO. The audio of the SPLA military spokesman is courtesy of Dennis Dumo, a freelance journalist based in Juba. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Nairobi.
A new report by the human rights group Amnesty International says Australia's treatment of asylum seekers amounts to torture under international law. About 1,200 asylum seekers have been forcibly transferred to what Australia calls an offshore processing center on the Pacific island of Nauru. As Henry Ritual reports from London, Amnesty says it interviewed refugees and whistleblowers from companies contracted to run the asylum centers.
In strikingly direct terms, Amnesty International accuses Australia of deliberately inflicting suffering on refugees. Audrey Gogran is head of global issues at the organisation.
Essentially, they've chosen to treat women, men and children with unspeakable cruelty on Nauru as a way to implement a policy designed to stop boats arriving in Australia.
The group says many refugees have mental health problems, adding it has documented cases of self-harm and suicide.
It's an open prison and they can't leave. We've documented cases of physical assault, cases of sexual assault, cases of people who are ill but cannot appear to get the right kinds of treatment. Very harrowing cases where you see parents watching their children suffer and they can't do anything about it.
Even refugees who have successfully applied for asylum in Australia are being forced to stay on Nauru. Among them is Ellie, an Iranian human rights activist, who says via Skype she has been given refugee status.
My case got positive result and I'm a refugee now, but I'm still in Nauru. No third country, no Australia, no way. I'm still in the jail.
Australia says its tough policies are vital to halt people smuggling. Speaking last month at the UN General Assembly, Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull called his country the ultimate immigration nation.
Porous borders drain away public support for multiculturalism, for immigration, for aid to refugees. Most importantly, the only way to stop the scourge of people smuggling is to deprive the people smugglers of their product. And secure borders do just that.
Amnesty describes that position as untenable and is calling on Australia to shut down its offshore processing centres and allow legitimate refugees to enter Australia. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Cheating on exams is not new. What is new is how students are doing it now. No more writing answers on their hands or a slap on the wrist if they are caught. Smart technology has transformed cheating, and stopping it has become a global challenge. As Faisal El-Masri tells us and narrated by Fifth Lapidus, it requires smart, comprehensive solutions.
The problem, says technology and social media expert Niall Nickel, can seem overwhelming.
Just take the cell phone or even the programmable calculators. There's so much information that could be stored in those devices. We also have things like Google Glass, as well as smart contact lenses that have the ability to capture video and transmit it to a remote site, and with things like smart watches where they could now look at their wristwatch basically for the answers to a question.
Earlier this year, several Thai students were caught using that technique to cheat on entrance exams to a top medical school. Other high-tech devices that facilitate cheating include a watch that appears to display nothing, but when you put on special glasses sold with a watch, the screen becomes visible and you can see any uploaded content.
You've also have Bluetooth devices. They're using some super high-frequency ringtones on their phone that only young people could hear. In fact, if you're much over the age of 30 or 35, you can't hear it. And so they're able to answer their phone where nobody knows that they're answering a phone, and they're not talking. They're just getting the answers in their ear.
There's a reason that the kids are cheating.
Denise Pope is senior lecturer at Stanford University and co-founder of Challenge Success, an organization that works with schools and families to improve student well-being and engagement with learning. She says cheating is a symptom of a bigger problem.
It's not the kids who you would think would normally cheat. These are kids who are doing well in school, and they are still cheating because they need to keep up their grades. They feel the pressure to maintain a really high grade point average. So a lot of the kids will say there's too much work to be done and there's not enough time to do it. Some of the kids will say we have to do that because everybody's cheating, and if you don't cheat, it's actually like you're being punished for not cheating.
To combat cheating in the age of smart technology, educational institutions are coming up with innovative strategies, from banning all devices from testing rooms to screening for radio signals. But Pope says improving the learning and testing process can be more effective.
Instead of trying to chase this problem, to get out in front of it. And what I mean by that is to create assignments where it's almost impossible to cheat. And I'll give you some examples. Asking kids to turn in multiple drafts of their essays or their projects so that you know it's their own work and you can give them feedback. This is, by the way, just better teaching, not just to stop cheating, but it's a better way to teach. And, you know, when it comes to tests and assessments, it's much more difficult to cheat on what we would call constructed response assessment, where you're actually writing the response as opposed to circling or filling in bubbles, which is much, much easier to cheat. You have no idea if the kids did it on their own or if they guessed or if they copied from a neighbor.
Inviting teachers, students, and their parents to openly talk about the problem can be part of the solution. Researcher Denise Pope says engaging students and emphasizing high standards for honesty can also be crucial in preventing cheating. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The South Sudan Army says it killed more than 50 rebels and members of militia groups and wounded several others during clashes that took place Sunday west of the town of Malakal. Army spokesman Brigadier General Lou Ruel Kong escorted a group of journalists over the weekend to the scene of the clashes in the Upper Nile region, where he said government forces inflicted heavy casualties on forces loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar. Kwan says the death toll among the SPLA in opposition forces could rise. He says government forces lost 4 fighters and at least 20 others were wounded in clashes that began Friday evening. Ghanaian police plan to meet this week with leaders of the Muslim community as part of their effort to meet with all stakeholders ahead of presidential, legislative and local elections scheduled for December 7th this year. Police spokesman Cephas Arthur says that the police have also launched a nationwide education campaign using mass and social media platforms to engage the public regarding the need to ensure a peaceful general election. That is it for this Tuesday, October 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.